I love listening to inquiries. Something I can remember when I was a manager at Gaia House in England, meditation center that Christopher and Christina founded in Devon in southwest England, and I was living there for a while as one of the managers. And whenever there was an inquiry on a retreat, I would make sure to be there. Just something, I don't know, that is so deeply touching, deeply inspiring. No matter what actually the inquiry is about, how clear or non-clear, whatever it is, just this human struggle for finding clarity. I don't know, I always feel very touched by that. And I can certainly say for myself that very, very often when sitting and listening to the inquiry that these really courageous yogis are doing, and sitting there, I was just so often, there was a moment when I could find clarity suddenly in myself. Probably I hadn't even known that there was unclarity before, there was confusion before, but wow, as such a brave human being coming up to the front and exposing him or herself. And that, I actually wonder if I ever had the courage myself to do that. Certainly not more than once or twice. Huh? It's a special situation one puts oneself in, and it's got something. I find that moment, where one is really struggling with finding truth, finding some clarity, that has almost got something archetypal, something that many people experience, something that is so universal in our existence on Earth, isn't it? And again, during the days here, I've heard a lot of respect and admiration for everyone who came here to the front, and I was reminded also of that of the story of Siddhartha Gautama, who became the Buddha, the one who is awake, the awakened one, through his enlightenment, and who was called before Gautama, the prince who lived about 2,500 years ago in the north of India. And probably quite a few of you are familiar with the story of how he was born as a prince and raised in utter luxury of that time, everything just available, and having plenty of pleasantness around. And then how he left the palace and went into homelessness, and he left the very extremely luxurious life. So I keep that part of the story pretty short. And he went into homelessness, he left all his status and rank and family and everything behind. And in fact he was wandering in very austere practices for about 6 years. Really dedicating his whole life to finding freedom. He felt there was nothing else to do for him but finding that ultimate freedom. And that sense, and just reflecting on that sense of a single human being, that, wow, there's actually nothing for me to do here right now, but finding that freedom, that resolve, is enormous. Following that call into homelessness. And then actually he went from that one extreme into the other extreme of utter austerity, and that also didn't work. He learned all kind of practices and fasting and was studying a lot, and still knew there was no freedom. There was still suffering in that. And as the story goes, he became so weak through all these austerities that one day he was just too exhausted to carry on, and he was very, very meager because he had hardly eaten anything. And the description of it, as one reads it sometimes, is that when he tried to feel his belly, he could actually feel all the way through to his backbone. That's how thin he was. Extremely austere practice. And so he was too exhausted to carry on, and he was just lying somewhere near a place called Bodh Gaya, somewhere under a tree, and unable to do anything. And then something very lovely happened. I particularly like that point in the story. Is he was there, not able to move backwards and forwards, and no level. And then a young maiden from the next village came, and she saw him lying there, extremely exhausted. And she didn't think twice. She just went back, got a bowl of rice, came back to Siddhartha Gautama, and she offered that bowl of rice or milk rice to him. And he accepted it. He had hardly eaten anything for a long time. He accepted that offering that came from that woman, and he ate, and he got slowly back to his strength, to his physical strength. And of course, you know, the story of the Buddha is not just a historical story, it is a mythological story as well, and it's highly symbolic in many areas. And this one, I don't know, it's something about it that I like very much. It's that spiritual seeker gone from one extreme into the other extreme, you know, almost killing himself on this spiritual quest, and there comes that feminine being offering a bowl of milk rice. And actually, as the story goes on, you know, the path that he discovered was then what we call the middle way, you know, between the extremes, between extreme one side, extreme other side, but something of the middle way. And I feel it's just a lovely image to reflect on sometimes. You know, what does it mean to be offered something, to be nourished, but to be supported by something, and also to accept that support. So that place where all that happened 2,500 years ago is in the north of India, called Bodh Gaya. That happened close to Bodh Gaya, and of course many of you have been there as retreats going on. It's a pilgrimage place very much today. And the Siddhartha Gautama walked a few meters from that place where he actually was offered that rice and milk, and sat down on under that famous Bodhi tree there. And he made that resolve not to get up until he had discovered utter and ultimate freedom. Simply not to get up, just be there, sitting there, no matter what. And just imagine to making such a resolve. Yeah. It's not like, again, it's highly symbolic. We don't have to sit down under some particular olive tree and say, well, I won't get up until I've reached enlightenment, until I've found freedom. It's more making that resolve in the mind not to give up. Sometimes remembering that resolve in the mind when sitting in the meditation hall, that kind of keep going, that kind of persistence, no matter how difficult it sometimes is. And it's not to push ourselves through any particular difficulties or extreme situations, it's just having that quiet and calm resolve and the trust that it's possible to discover freedom, just like the Buddha 2,500 years ago, and many, many beings after him. So actually when the Buddha sat down under that famous Bodhi tree, and there's still a Bodhi tree today, I think it's in the second or third generation today, and of course next to it is a wonderful, I personally find very wonderful, very special stupa, Mahabodhi temple in Bodh Gaya. When he sat down there, he was tempted by Mara, that is the archetype, so to speak, in the Buddhist mythology, that is seducing the seeker or seducing the practitioner with all kind of illusions of distractions and so on. So he was sitting there and Mara came, and Mara usually comes with his armies, so his forces are very much greed, aversion and delusion. And it is described that Siddhartha Gautama sat under that Bodhi tree and Mara was coming and was tempting him with the power of greed. And that's maybe something, you know, where we've been in a similar situation on a retreat here, of wanting what I don't have or not wanting what I have, wanting more comfort, wanting more sleep, wanting more calmness, wanting this, wanting that, wanting the other. And it's really a temptation, it's really the illusion of thinking, if only I had this particular thing, if only I had a little bit more calmness, if only I had a little less fear, then I could see clearly. I remember one long retreat that I once said I was getting up in the morning and there was one of the managers in the house, and he got up long before me, couldn't sleep that night, and he had the wonderful idea of making some fresh bakery. I think he started like 4 o'clock in the morning because he was sleepless, and the whole house was full of this lovely smell, you know, and it was immediately like stimulating. Yes. And so we were kind of expecting some nice croissant or something for breakfast, and indeed they turned up on the table, and I was, wow, yeah, wonderful. It was like dreams becoming true, you know, after weeks of just porridge. So took one, glad to have one, sitting down in that room where we were sitting for breakfast, sitting down and looking at this croissant, contemplating how wonderful it is to have a croissant in the morning, you know. And what then happened was just so revealing. Then a thought came, just a single thought, a little voice, and now to have a nice café au lait. Just one cup, you know. And then I would be totally happy. Of course it was not even a Nescafe or anything in the house, it was just some herb tea or so. And so I had this croissant, and something of course was missing, because, you know, what I wanted wasn't there complete, but only half of what I then wanted at that moment was there to satisfy me, but the other half was missing, so it was still not the perfect situation. And that was really a moment of insight, that this force of greed, you know, it's bottomless. It's bottomless. There's always something missing. There's always something I could think of that is still missing. There could always be something improved. And just to taste that taste of greed, the taste of desire, the taste of not enough. I'm really seeing it so clearly. And one can't think of a good explanation or excuse, you know, why this now should be different, but just to see the rawness of greed at that moment. I think, of course, I still remember that moment after years. You know, it's unforgettable in a way. And that was clearly Mara tempting me at that morning, tempting me with the wanting more, something different. Just in the same way as the Buddha was tempted under the Bodhi tree. Sometimes greed comes in, particularly on retreats, and you know, one comes on the retreat and one starts to look at other people and starts with all these projections onto other people, and how nice it would be to talk more to each other, to find out more about each other. One gets into fantasizing. This might be a particular feature that one likes about the other person, and gets into this whole stream of thoughts and fantasies, and goes right into fantasizing of how it would be to actually to come together. I mean, there must be something magical about meeting on a particular situation, you know, like a spiritual retreat. It's meant that we've met. It's meant to meet. It's meant that we come together. You know, one gets into this whole subtle or sometimes quite gross desire of, you know, taking it from here and letting it unfold. And it's commonly called a vipassana romance. You know, and the other day somebody was talking to me how he spent, I think, almost the entire retreat just thinking about that other person he had never spoken to before. He'd only seen once very briefly in the beginning of that retreat, you know, and then they went into silence and then the whole story began, you know. God. And he said at the end of the retreat he was just so exhausted from just indulging in this fantasy. So what would you like, you know, to come together and to wander off into the sunset? and it kept him going on this fantasy level days after day in the silence, and was clearly completely lost in this realm of thoughts and desire and greed. And there's nothing bad about it. It's just sometimes it's good to know that this can happen. It's good that this is a very common experience, actually, and sometimes in that silence it can just build up so much. And it's clearly one of the temptations of Mara. As I think it's even mentioned that at one point Mara, you know, where Mara tries various ways of seducing the Buddha through greed, hatred, or delusion, and then nothing works, and then he sends out his beautiful daughters to, and they dance around him, and they try to seduce him with that sweetness. But even that doesn't work. There's this clear resolve of finding complete freedom. Another temptation that Mara sends out is aversion in all its forms and colors. And of course it can be just raw anger, it can be hatred, it can be boredom, it can be often lies under the more visible aversion is the anxiety or fear. It belongs all in that realm of aversion, actually. Or conceit or arrogance, or whatever, that might be. And one can really be tempted and seduced by that as well. The seduction is not so much that it happens, it's not so much where it takes us, it's actually the illusion of this is who I really am, putting a great sense creating a great sense of self in that, in a way identifying with greed, hatred or delusion. Yeah. That is the seduction in it. It's not that it happens at all, but putting one's identity in it and going in that direction. Really believing this is who I am. And of course we are not, but then we are in a way in Mara's hands, because we are believing in that illusion. So if that is happening, just to see how Mara is tempting, to see how he's keeping us from the clear seeing, from the clear insight, same with delusion or confusion. Sometimes everything seems to be so foggy when we are sitting. Some people have reported there's a feeling like being spaced out, and that can be a form of delusion also, or not really understanding what is going on, misunderstanding things. Misunderstanding the body, misunderstanding emotions, not really seeing, not really knowing. But we put a lot of sense of self into that and think this is it, and we handed ourselves over into Mara's hands. So really these temptations of Mara, I was just reminded today, you know, when people were yesterday too, in the inquiry, really trying to look, to understand. It's like sitting under the Bodhi tree, and Mara comes, you know, with all kinds of attacks, you know, sometimes multiple attacks from all sides, with all kind of armies, you know, and one struggles to stay with one's resolve of wanting to see, of yearning to see. It's just the same situation. And then in the story of Siddhartha Gautama, when he was confronted with doubt, actually whether he could do that at all, who on earth he actually was, to sit down under some Bodhi tree somewhere and decide, well, I'm not going to get up until I've found utter freedom. You know, and Mara sent that doubt and said, well, who on earth do you actually think you are that you could get fully enlightened? Huh? Who do you think you are? And the doubt became quite strong, and something lovely then happened. Siddhartha Gautama just put his hand on Mother Earth and asked her to bear witness for his birthright to do what he was doing. Just that connection with Mother Earth. Well, I think it doesn't say Mother Earth, but I do. Mother Earth. That carries us and that can bear witness for the birthright to find freedom from suffering. So maybe when there are moments of fear, when there are moments of anxiety in this whole practice, when there are moments of what is consciousness? And who am I in all of that? What? Who's it? Who am I? What is happening? I'm not the body, not the emotions, not the thinking, not the state of mind, but who am I on earth? Finding that, you know, that being supported by all of life, you know, that this is possible, that there is no doubt that we can do this work. That can be really just really a body gesture sometimes to reconfirm that birthright. Some years ago, I don't know where I got this description from, but it's from some book, and it's described in there how these armies of Mara are attacking Siddhartha Gautama, and I would just like to read that out because it's actually quite a description of it, and probably if some of you have gone through quite some difficulties during the last days or today or whenever in the future, just to remember that this is something that what many of us are going through or have gone through, and this is not just that one person is struggling, but this is the mythological description how Siddhartha Gautama himself struggled. So it goes like this: over the course of the night he battled with the forces of greed, aversion and delusion in his mind, all personified by the dark deity of Mara. Bolts of lightning and the deep rumble of thunder heralded the onslaught of Mara. A searing and blinding flash exploded in front of Siddhartha. A tall tree split lengthwise and wrapped in flames crashed down to earth before him. It's quite something. Has anybody experienced that? And the Buddha said, Mara! And actually it goes on. It says, Mara, I know you. I know you. I know this is greed. I know this is aversion. I know this is delusion. I know this is to seduce me. This is to get me off track. Mara, I know you. Sometimes that is enough to silently say to oneself, Mara, I know you. The foliage of the tree above his head began to hiss in the fiery wind. The wind itself seemed to carry the sound of a million screams. The ground quaked and groaned, and a huge chasm opened up before him, and the very earth trembled and shook. The army of Mara attacked from all directions. From all directions. Greed, hate and delusion at the same time, from all directions. Everything. Mara unleashed whirlwinds, meteor showers and the darkest blackness in a great effort to seduce the mind of Siddhartha with the forces of greed, aversion and delusion. And then, very lovely, it goes on. However, the rain did not wet him. The wind did not ever flutter his garments. What could that mean? There's this incredible attack going on from all sides, armies from all sides, and rain and thunderstorm and lightning, you know. Of course, it's all in a highly symbolical sense. But the rain did not wet him. The wind did not ever flutter his garments. And he stretched forth his right hand towards the earth and touched the ground with his fingers. He asked the earth to bear witness to his right to be sitting where he was. She did so with a mighty thundering that arose from the depth of the earth. At the same time, an invincible roar overwhelmed the armies of Mara, who immediately took flight. So that was the night of the enlightenment of the Buddha. the night where he found or realized freedom, where he actually conquered those armies of illusion. And interesting enough, as the story then goes on, Mara comes back later again and again, you know, even after the Night of Enlightenment, you know, but there's no way they could invade that freedom anymore, no way. But still, Mara came back several times later. So that's also something interesting to reflect on, these temptations. And in a way, this battling with illusions, this is something going on probably more often than we think. All those concepts of reality that we have, all the ideas about ourselves and others, all the concepts of what is important, of what really says something about ourselves, how we really express ourselves, what we really are. And very often we actually hold quite fast onto thoughts about ourselves. I think Stephen spoke this morning about thoughts and the process of thinking. And really it's quite something in this practice to discover the nature of thoughts. Our thoughts can come through a pure mind, just like a bird flying along the sky, the blue sky. Just birds flying through. Sometimes you hear the image of clouds coming through, but actually a bird is a lovely image, isn't it? Those thoughts are not necessarily the enemies or things that shouldn't be there. It's just something coming through the clear sky. And we put so much of our identity often into them, or try to catch a bird and put it in a cage and solidify it somehow and say, well, this is really me. You know, this idea about myself, the idea about my family, the idea about my country, whatever. And that is the something where we really solidify something that by its nature can't be put into a cage. It's, by its nature, it can't be. Somehow we freeze the mind if we identify with a concept about ourselves. One of those concepts would, for example, be the thinking of the pair of praise and blame. Identifying a lot with praise when it comes, but actually also identifying a lot with blame when it comes. And it comes regularly into our lives. You know, people like or we don't like what we are doing, and they say something about us, and then there's a lot of hearing this praise and we feel all good and yes, this is really who I am. Or there's a lot of blame and we feel really bad and think, oh yes, this is really who I am. That's praise and blame. And these are concepts, these are ideas, and we think this is saying something about us as a person or our self-worth. And it's a tragedy to hold on to that in heavy ways. Of course, I guess hardly anyone can be completely unaffected by praise and blame. It's nice when praise comes, it's not so nice when blame comes. Yet, is it possible to take that lightly? Is it possible to see that as a concept, as a something that is insubstantial, as a view, as an opinion, but absolutely not worth holding on to? So praise, let's look at that concept of praise and blame. You know, that's wanting for approval. It's actually something that is quite widespread, you know, that kind of need to be seen and need to be approved of our actions, of our thoughts, of our work, of our choice of partner, of our income, of our journeys, of our feelings, of our artwork, of our food, no matter what. The list is endless. And to wait for some kind of, you know, approval makes it really hard to find anything like integrity, honesty with oneself. If we make ourselves so dependent on what somebody else says about it, and it's a matter of chance whether the person likes what we're doing or doesn't like what we're doing and says, well, great what you're doing, or actually it's hopeless what you're doing. Yeah. So how does that influence our lives? You know, if we find a partner, stay, are quite happy with each other, and then somebody comes along and says, well, you know, the person you live with, you know, I really like you, but there's something I need to tell you. What influence does that have on our sense of self, sense of who we are, sense of self-worth? Or what influence does it have, you know, if we are with a partner and much love, wonderful time, gone through a lot of things together, but actually partnership is coming to an end. One doesn't quite know how to finish it. And then friends, family, anybody around says, well, you are just such a lovely couple. It's just so wonderful how you fit together. You are made for each other. Yeah. Whew. Yes, but so praise and blame that comes from outside and might not be in accordance with what we really experience, you know, can bring us, take us into places of real trouble, real unease. If we give it a lot of authority over our lives. And it's really, the part of the trouble is always that we give it authority, that we actually don't feel all that confident about how we really feel. I've got a friend who's an artist, and it's a drama when there's an exhibition of his paintings and sculptures, and there's a critic coming in, the critic doesn't like it at all, and he's writing about it, and it's not very nice what the critic is writing, and there's this absolute disaster for a few days. And then the next time somebody comes in his studio and is just in love with his artwork, just wonderful, genius, you know, wonderful, yes, I buy this and that and that, and this is really it, you are the new star. Well, then you should see him, you know, then it's a completely different person suddenly. And of course it's understandable, isn't it? I mean, art is quite often something, you know, whether it's painting or sculpturing or making music or writing or whatever, just dancing, something we put our heart into. And somebody comes along and says, well, this is all rubbish. Or saying, yes, but, you know, a little bit more training and you will get there. So let's just look at these forces when they come in our lives, you know. Is that an illusion? Is that something that can really say something about ourselves? Is that something where we want to give our whole investment in, but that stops our journey, you know, where we say, well, this is true, this is who I am, I found it, and this is my true self. or is it just a momentary judgment, a thought, a concept, something within the realm of good or bad, pleasant or unpleasant, left, right, high, low, bright, dark, praise, blame, gain, loss, whatever it is, and something that will never ultimately satisfy us, something that cannot give us a sense of integrity, a sense of authenticity, a sense of resting and unshakability. This freedom from those duality lies right in the midst of it all. But we need to see that, and we can only see it when we are not completely caught up in it. So what is it that can see the praise and the blame? We've been talking about that quite a lot over the days. Today in the inquiry, very lovely. Yeah? What is it that can actually just, where is this utter stillness in the midst of it all? Call it consciousness, call it awareness, or don't give it a name. The name is just a name. We can even just for a split moment get a taste of that, you know, just get one little taste of it, seeing from that point, seeing the world of illusion, of pro and con, the world of duality that is always somehow in conflict. That things fall suddenly into perspective, and we can take them very lightly. So don't worry if you're battling, if you're wrestling is the word. Don't worry if it's all not so clear. Just keep on trusting, making that resolve, and if there's just a zip, just a little taste of it, and even if it's completely foggy afterwards again, it doesn't matter. Just a little taste of that stillness. Sweetness, and the understanding that it does nourish, will change the way we live. It does change the way we relate. No, it does change our relationships with Mara. That's a beautiful thing. So I'd like to finish tonight with a lovely poem that probably some of you know. It's by Thich Nhat Hanh, it's a great Zen master who lives in the south of France. And he wrote some, don't know how long ago, but certainly some 20 years ago or more, a poem called Please Call Me By My True Names. Do not say that I'll depart tomorrow, because even today I still arrive. Look deeply. I arrive in every second, to be a bud on a spring branch, to be a tiny bird whose wings are still fragile, learning to sing in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in my new nest, to be a caterpillar in the heart of a flower, to be a jewel hiding itself in a stone. I still arrive in order to laugh and to cry, in order to fear and to hope, and the rhythm of my heart is the birth and death of all that are alive. I am the mayfly, metamorphosing on the surface of the river, and I am the bird which, when spring comes, arrives in time to eat the mayfly. I am the frog swimming happily in the clear water of a pond, and I am also the grass snake who, approaching in silence, feeds itself on the frog. I am the child in Uganda, all skin and bones, my legs as thin as bamboo sticks. And I am the arms merchant selling deadly weapons to Uganda. I am the 12-year-old girl, refugee on a small boat, who throws herself into the ocean after being raped by the sea pirate. And I am the sea pirate, my heart not yet capable of seeing and loving. I am a member of the Politburo, well, this is 20 years ago, with plenty of power in my hands. And I am the man who has to pay his debt of blood to my people dying slowly in a forced labor camp. My joy is like spring, so warm it makes flowers bloom. And my pain is like a river of tears, so full it fills up the four oceans.